Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. A free and just society places limits on government's police powers. America's founders put some of those limits in the Bill of Rights. Guarantees of freedom of speech, press, and peaceful assembly, redress of grievances, and protection against warrantless searches and seizures. For months, Edward Snowden has leaked revelations about mass surveillance of the communications of tens of millions of law-abiding Americans. He's breaking the law to expose what he believes is governmental abuse of the law. In assessing the facts, we ought to keep in mind that something similar has happened before and change the course of our nation's history. Betty Metzger knows, and with remarkable good timing, her new book, The Burglary, tells the story. Betty, many thanks for having us at your home in New York.
Thank you.
Tell us about your background. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up on a small farm in western Pennsylvania. The closest town was Johnstown.
That'll come to a surprise, I think, to some Montanans that there are small farms or were small farms in western Pennsylvania. Are they still there?
The small farms in western Pennsylvania weren't really being farmed when I was a kid. That's a hilly part of Pennsylvania, much like people think of West Virginia, very similar to the West Virginia countryside.
If our listeners doubted we were in New York, perhaps you heard the siren. Please continue.
The small farms in western Pennsylvania by that time weren't really farming much because it was pretty impossible to use a tractor.
So were your folks farmers?
No, not really. By the early 1940s, when I was born, it was no longer farmland. And instead, my father was a night watchman in an electric plant.
I see. Your mom?
My mother was a homemaker.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to Grove City College, a small, very conservative Presbyterian college in western Pennsylvania.
Now, you say conservative Presbyterian. That was your upbringing?
That was my upbringing, yes.
Now, when you say conservative, what are we? That word means different things to different people. Is that political as well as religion?
In that context, it definitely was theologically conservative. Mm-hmm. Presbyterians cover a wide range from conservative to quite liberal. But this was conservative, and also my family and people in that area were politically very conservative. And the college, that's true where I grew up and at the college.
So if I was to ask you from your early childhood through college what key values you learned that are still with you, what would you say?
That's a difficult question for me to answer because I changed so much after college.
Okay.
I was changed by becoming a journalist. I really didn't think. I was not a thinking person. All the way through college, I was spoon-fed, and I accepted pretty much whatever was given to me.
So what changed that?
For the first time, when I was a journalist in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, my first job was at the Johnstown Tribune-Democrat, for the first time, I started reading in a different way. I started reading news for the first time. I'd grown up in a home that didn't have newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have books, and really in college wasn't paying attention to the news, even though when I look back on it, it was such a crucial time. All of the civil rights major developments took place, many of them while I was in college. But when I got into that newsroom, I started reading the wires as they came over the wires, and it was the year of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. War in Vietnam. More importantly, there was a bookstore down the street from the newspaper, and an independent bookstore, and I would go to work an hour early, and the man who ran that bookstore, I consider him almost my most important teacher, Mr. Haggadus, and he guided me, and I started reading diligently for the first time, and he had me reading James Baldwin and Elie Wiesel simultaneously, and I consider that the beginning of my becoming a thinking person.
How did you end up at the Washington Post as a reporter?
I went from the Johnstown Tribune-Democrat to the Evening Bulletin in Philadelphia. And then at the end of 1969, was hired as a reporter at the Washington Post.
And when were you hired by the Post?
January 1970.
Okay, let's talk about the book. It deals with a burglary that took place, as you write, on the day or the evening of the first Muhammad Ali-Joe Frazier fight, 1971, March 8th, I think.
March 8th, 1971.
Okay, I remember the fight. I went to see it on closed circuit.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And there's a burglary of citizens of an FBI office. Tell us the story.
Well, the group that did the burglary was called the Citizen. They called themselves the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI. And they were led by a man named Bill Davidon, a physics professor at Haverford College. He and the people he invited to consider doing the burglary were all very active in the very large peace movement in Philadelphia. And at that time, there had been this growing sense from 1969 that peace organizations and also civil rights organizations had been infiltrated by spies. And at first, Bill, having a scientific mind and not being conspiratorial, thought that it was probably not true, that people were just so deflated by failing to stop the war that they were imagining this. And then he heard it so often, and the way people talked about it, he became convinced that there probably were spies infiltrating the peace movement. And he decided that if this was true, if the government was officially suppressing dissent, that this was an incredibly serious problem, a crime against democracy that ought to be stopped. But he couldn't think of any way that this could be done officially. He knew that there was no oversight over the FBI.
By Congress, you mean?
By Congress,
or
by
the
Attorney
branch.
General, who was technically the boss of J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, J. Edgar Hoover had been there for almost 50 years.
Right, and he realized that J. Edgar Hoover was practically worshipped by the American public.
And had intimidated elected officials through subtle and not subtle
That's right.
Blackmail.
Secretly.
None
of this was known to the public, but members of Congress and administrations had felt threatened by him.
So what did he decide to do then? He realizes he can't get support from the political establishment.
He decided that the only way to get evidence, he was determined that if this issue could be confronted by the public had to have evidence that dissent was being suppressed, that rhetoric, talking about it forever, would not do any good. And so he had been working with the Catholic peace movement in the past year and learned the art of burglary from nuns and priests.
Now that takes some explaining, but before you explain how someone learns the art of burglary from nuns and priests, let me tell our listeners, you're listening to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Betty Metzger about her new book, The Burglary. Nuns and priests?
The Catholic peace movement was a very effective part of the anti-war movement, although probably the least remembered and the least written about in the history of that era. And when people think of the Catholic peace movement, though, probably the Berrigan brothers are the people that they think about.
But I didn't know about burglaries.
Well, the Berrigan brothers' aggressive nonviolence consisted of such things as what happened at Catonsville, the Catonsville 9 case, where they went into a draft board office and raided and then waited to be arrested afterwards. But later on, the movement evolved into using a different method, and that was to actually go into draft boards and try to take as many files as possible in order to harm the system, make it more difficult for it to operate.
So Mr. Davidon learns from Catholic draft activists how to burglarize, and he does what with that knowledge?
He decided that burglary, much as he disliked it, was probably the only way that you could get documentary evidence of what J. Edgar Hoover was doing.
Okay, and he leads a group of people?
He invited people one by one, people he had met in the Catholic peace movement. They weren't all Catholics. In fact, only one of them was a Catholic. And he invited them to consider the idea, and they agreed with him that this was very important.
How many people?
There were eight in the end. There had been a ninth, and he abandoned the group shortly before the burglary.
The burglary, as I mentioned, was planned for the evening of the Ali Frazier fight, when I assumed they figured all the FBI folks would be listening or watching the fight on closed circuit. Did it go as planned?
That's true. They figured that people would be listening to the reports of the fight on their radios and televisions, and that turned out to be the case. And the fight provided noise cover at some crucial moments.
Did the burglary go as planned?
There were some problems. When the burglar who was trained himself as a lock picker arrived at the FBI office, there were two locks on the door, and he remembered only one. So this was a pretty shocking moment. And the one that seemed to have been added was a much more complicated lock than he was prepared to pick. And at that moment, he suggested that the burglary be called off.
If it was called off, you wouldn't have a book.
Well, if it had been called off, Americans would not have learned everything that they did learn about how J. Edgar Hoover operated. The FBI would not have been reformed. We would not have congressional oversight of the FBI, and we would not have a strengthened Freedom of Information Act and a lot of other things that flowed from the burglary.
So he runs into this terrible realization he can't get through the door that he figured. How did they get in?
Well, he called back to the hotel where the rest of the burglars were waiting and said, "I don't think it can be done." And the leader of the group, Bill Davidon, said, "Come back." Together, they thought about it, and they decided it was worth taking the risk. I mean, the lockpicker was afraid that there were FBI agents inside the office. And they decided to take the risk that probably that was not true. He went back, and this time he used a crowbar on a different door that didn't have the complicated lock. There were two external doors.
They seized a bunch of files.
Every piece of paper in the office.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
In the dark. They had no idea what was in there.
And the office was where?
Media, Pennsylvania, which is a small town, an old suburb outside Philadelphia.
So this burglary takes place. You're writing for the Washington Post. How did you hear about it?
Well, there was a tiny story about a burglary of a media FBI office, probably two paragraphs. That ran most places in the country. It didn't especially attract my attention, but I later realized I had seen that story. 2 weeks after the burglary, I received a manila envelope in my mailbox at the Washington Post, and the return address was Liberty Publications, Media, Pennsylvania. Didn't mean anything to me, but made me curious. Inside was a cover letter from the Citizens Commission and 14 files, and the cover letter said that they were copies of files that they had stolen. And they were fairly dramatic. As I read them, I didn't know whether they were authentic, but the FBI confirmed that they were authentic an hour later. And one of those files was a policy statement. And this file became emblematic of the burglary. It was a policy statement in which agents were urged to, quote, enhance the paranoia, close quote, and make people think there's an FBI agent behind every mailbox. Well, that was a pretty strong thing to be reading.
Yeah, let me just ask you about this now. Here you are, a reporter for the Washington Post. Somebody sends you something. You're skeptical of the authenticity. It's sent anonymously. The committee had, these people didn't sign their names, right? Because they just committed
anonymous.
A burglary. They'd committed a crime.
Right.
You're sitting there reading this, and you read what you just said, enhanced paranoia, suggesting clearly infiltration by law enforcement into peace groups. What was your emotional reaction?
I was startled when I read that. For one thing, I was surprised that a law enforcement agency would have that kind of statement in writing.
I guess so.
In its files. So that was startling. And that statement did make me think, you know, are these real?
Mm-hmm.
But I've been a reporter in Philadelphia, so as I continued to read, I saw reports on people whose names were familiar to me from my time there as a reporter. As I read, I did eventually come to believe that they were authentic.
But belief is different than what I'm asking you. I said your emotional reaction. In other words, as a reporter, true or not, I can certainly appreciate you're going through that. Is this real? Is this a forgery? No, this isn't a forgery. Were you excited? Were you yawning? I mean, this sounded to me like this is a huge scoop that's been dropped in your lap.
Well, I wasn't sure.
Okay.
And so I'm eager. I'm certainly eager. And I want to read more. It's not as though I'm jumping up and down, but I'm startled and I'm eager. And as I read, it certainly seems like it's very important information. And although I wasn't covering the FBI very much at that time, I realized that this was very important if it was true and that it was something that the public needed to know.
I need to tell our listeners, the book is sort of like a thriller, and I don't want to give away all the story, but we've got a lot of ground to cover, so I'm going to jump ahead. You're writing these stories, but there's a decision that has to be made by the Washington Post to publish or not. Now, my recollection is the Nixon administration suggested strongly that they not publish. Fair?
The Attorney General kept calling two editors and then Catherine Graham that afternoon, throughout the afternoon.
Catherine Graham being the
publisher of the Washington Post, and demanding that they not publish. This was, in fact, the first time that the Nixon administration demanded that Catherine Graham suppress a story on behalf of the
And she obviously decided to go ahead. Do you know why?
Well, I think that the editors were made a very convincing case to her that this was important public information, that they find out that the FBI operated as these documents described them, and that it was unimportant how we obtained the documents. That was the difficult part. It was the first time that a journalist had received secret government files from people outside the government who had stolen them. So that became an ethical, legal issue to give pause. And the editors convinced her that it was how we received them didn't matter. It was what they said.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're in New York talking with author Betty Metzger about her fascinating book, The Burglary. I'm assuming that when a story comes out in the Washington Post like that, this first sort of scandalous expose, it got tremendous press.
It did.
Okay. What were the key elements that, looking back, were contained in those files? Two or three key things to you, the most important revelations.
Well, I think in the end, the most important revelations from all of the media files, the revelation of two very large programs in the FBI. One was a security index, a list that Hoover secretly maintained and kept enlarging of people who the FBI would detain in the event of a national emergency. Another one that was extremely important was something called COINTELPRO, which stood for Counterintelligence Program. And this had no law enforcement purpose and no real intelligence gathering purpose. It was purely harassment, but harassment that sometimes came to the level of violence, even the killing of people. An example of the COINTELPRO operations, one was something that resulted in the killing of Fred Hampton, a Black Panther member official in Chicago. An FBI informant provided the information, a little map for a Chicago police shooter to how where Fred Hampton's bed was in a given room where he could go to kill him, and did. And that FBI informer was congratulated on the end result.
Was this man a convicted felon that they were trying to capture?
Fred Hampton? No, he wasn't.
I mean, he was
an official of the
Black
Panthers.
And he was murdered?
And he was murdered. He was murdered by a Chicago police shooter in his bedroom. Examples of the harassment sort of range from crude to cruel to unbelievable. For instance, injecting oranges of activists with laxatives.
You mean oranges that they might eat? Is that the idea?
Oranges that they might eat. And also hiring prostitutes known to have venereal disease in an effort to entrap activists or the Free Cuba Committee.
But you're saying the FBI did things like this.
That's right.
It was their program, COINTELPRO.
The harassment ranged from just crude things to things that sent some people to prison falsely for decades. A third thing that became known as a result of the media files was massive harassment, blanket surveillance of black people in this country.
Now, this was related in Hoover's mind because he was in charge to the civil rights movement. Is that what was going on, or his suspicion?
I'm talking about the entire black population of the United States. Very specific policies that had people under surveillance, and it was very specific in the media files as to what kinds of people should be hired to go into the black community as informers, and also where they should do surveillance. And that included just about every place where a person would go, their local store, their church, their library, restaurants, bars.
I think to most ears today, that sounds pretty wild, pretty extreme. So I'd ask you a couple of questions with a footnote. Now, I know J. Edgar Hoover had no black FBI agents, none.
That's right. And in the files, he makes it clear that he saw black people as being potentially dangerous. He felt this way, especially about young black people and students. For instance, every black student at Swarthmore College was under surveillance by the FBI. For black people in America at that time, and we're talking about throughout the 1960s mm-hmm. and the early 70s, it really was the same as for East Germans during the years of the Stasi under communist rule. You never knew who was an informer. They were throughout your community.
Let's talk about the impact that these revelations had. You summarized them quickly in relation to the burglary. What happens now? The story's out. Hoover's terribly embarrassed. What happens?
Well, Hoover was apoplectic about the burglary and initiated an enormous investigation. But the immediate reaction when the first revelations came out was that for the first time, members of Congress called for an investigation of the FBI. There must have been about six members of Congress that immediately issued that.
Only six. There are 435 members, if my memory serves.
Well, only one had suggested this before.
That just simply clearly reflects the power that J. Edgar Hoover
had. Enormous power. Enormous
power. Okay, so they call for investigation.
They call for an investigation. And also the major newspapers, including newspapers that had only applauded Hoover before this time, mm-hmm. Called for an investigation. That did not take place then, and I think that is a tribute to how powerful he was. But mm-hmm. the ball was rolling at that point and continued to roll. And one thing Congress did do was by 1974 strengthen the Freedom of Information Act. And that impact from the revelations was one of the most powerful things
so
that happened.
So people could get information from their FBI files.
It became slightly easier mm-hmm. for people to get their FBI files. And that led to the first files coming out and then a stream of files that goes on to this day so that we have gradually learned the true history of the FBI of that era. But then the most important thing probably was that by 1975, Congress finally decided to investigate. And the most important investigations that took place were those by a Senate committee known as the Church Committee.
Frank Church from Idaho.
Frank Church from Idaho. And that committee investigated the FBI and the CIA, all intelligence agencies. Mm-hmm. That had never happened before. And the result of those investigations is the establishment by Congress of the first congressional oversight of the intelligence agencies. The mechanism was put in place and has been used numerous times since then.
We're running short of time, but I would like to make an editorial comment that obviously the Snowden revelations about the scale of mass surveillance raises questions about the efficacy of that oversight. We don't have time to go into that in this show. But I'd like to focus on something of the personal story here. As I remember from the book, the FBI's investigations were not successful. They never caught the burglars. And roughly 20 years later, what happens?
I happened to be visiting Philadelphia. I was having dinner with two acquaintances from the years when I worked there. And the father, man in the family, as the daughter entered the room, I said, Mary, we want you to meet Betty, because many years ago when your dad and mother had information about the FBI, we wanted to give to the American public, we sent it to Betty.
Let me get this straight. One of the burglars is telling his daughter, this is the person we sent the material to, and you're there.
Right.
Now, what was your reaction?
I was amazed. I couldn't believe it. I had never had any idea who the burglars were. I was interested only in the substance of the files, hadn't given it much thought. And here they were, sort of a typical suburban couple with four children, three of them born by the time of the burglary. And they told me that they were two of eight of the media burglars.
Obviously, that had to be, as you say, a stunning event. Is that where you got the idea to write the book?
Shortly after that, I was not able to think of much else besides having learned their identity and what an important story it was. And so I got in touch with them soon after. And my intent was to write about all of the burglars and how in the world it was possible for them to have the courage to do this, but also tell the story of the enormous impact of the burglary.
I don't know if our listeners can hear the patriotic band that is playing in Broadway just below us, but it's a fitting time for me to ask this question. Someone might say these people broke the law. They committed a burglary of a law enforcement agency. They got away without punishment. It's wrong, whatever the consequences. What would you say to that question?
I understand that concern. It was an extreme situation where dissent was being suppressed far more than the burglars even had any idea of, as it turned out. And it turned out that they had to commit a crime in order to reveal a much more massive crime that was being committed against the American public. I consider it one of the most powerful acts of nonviolent resistance in history. But I think in order to understand the rationale, it's important to think of such things as the Underground Railroad.
When you say the Underground Railroad, you're speaking of?
I'm speaking of the effort to free the slaves and the people who secretly helped make passage of slaves from the South to the North.
Which was a felony in the South.
Which was a felony.
Breaking the law.
And also, you know, some people will think, well, why didn't they make themselves public and take the punishment immediately? And yet the Underground Railroad operated the same way. It could not have continued to operate except for the secrecy involved.
But if I understand correctly, the burglary group remained totally anonymous until this year.
Until January 7th of this year, yes.
Betty Metzger, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.